Okay, well, as you've heard, so I'm going to talk about the program that we have been organizing for this fall in pattern formation in physics and biology. And I try to give just an introduction to what it is, you know, because I figured that most of the string theorists wouldn't know what pattern formation and, you know, physics and biology, what it could even mean or what that could be. So what I do is I give a kind of a general introduction. I will show you some movies because I couldn't refrain of showing you some dynamics, because we have the advantage, we actually have movies of things that happen that you can observe in a lifetime. And so I wanted to show you these movies because it gives you a little bit the flavor of what we are studying, what we are trying to get into, what the theorists try to understand. I should mention that my main profession is I'm an experimental physicist, so you have to forgive me if I'm perhaps sometimes not too theoretical about things. And I actually, on purpose, tried not to put down. There are no formulas in my talk because I try to stay away from them, because David told me there will be another talk where there are lots and lots of formulas allowed, and people can really dive into the subject. So the first thing that what's important is what we do is we study non-equilibrium systems. So we study systems that are driven out of equilibrium. And one nice picture that you can draw for this is, you know, so here you have the sun, and it's delivering energy to the Earth. And what happens on the Earth? Entropy doesn't go up. Well, it does. But what we see are structures and phenomena on the Earth which are very, very ordered. Like the best example is us here. For example, you know, Greece are growing, which have a very nice dendritic structure. They're very ordered. And at the same time, you know, there's life. So there are people running around on the Earth. And in addition, you know, we have little animals running around and things like that. And so what happens is we put energy in the system, and the system does nothing better than making structure and patterns and things. And so the question is, you know, how is this all coming about? And so the first thing is, what we need that energy is flowing into the system all the time. So we're putting energy in right now. In lunch, we're eating. If we wouldn't be eating, you know, we would leave. We basically die and we're gone. The structure has disappeared. So we constantly need energy. And there are many, what needs to these patterns are many microscopic steps. Well, if you think about us, then the microscopic steps are so complicated that we can't even address them. We can't even think about it, how life came about, how we came about. It's just too complicated. So what you want to do is you want to first study systems that are perhaps not quite as sophisticated as a human being. You want to study simpler things. And what I want to study is, so we have all these many microscopic steps, and as a result, we get a phenomenon, you know, some order, let's call it order, at the macro scale. Okay? So this is what we get. And so what I thought is, the question, so what is pattern formation? And so the question is, basically, as I see it, are their principles for self-organization. So this is what I call, this is what I would like to call, in my opinion, pattern formation. Of course, anybody is allowed to contradict or, you know, ask questions and so on. But this is, for me, is pattern formation is, are there some principles underlying the self-organization that we see in nature, and can we describe it, and can we get insights into these phenomena? Well, then we can ask yourself, what is common to these systems? Well, the first thing I said is, you know, most of them are, well, basically all of them are externally driven. So they're dissipative. They're little machines. So we put in energy, we let energy go through the system, the energy leaves the systems again. And so they're little machines, they're little motors. And the other important thing is that we need is that they're nonlinear. All of these systems are typically nonlinear, so they show nonlinear behavior. And very often when we think about these more simple systems, which I will come to, what we do is, we very often describe these systems, what I would call microscopically, by partial differential equations, either 1D, 2D, or 3D. And that's what we do. And so I would call this the microscopic description is very often it's just PDEs. But then if we go a little bit further back,
you may want to put microscopic in quotes.
In quotes. Yes, it's not, I'm not talking about string theory or quantum mechanics. I'm talking about what for us is the microscopic description, which is, for example, Navier-Stokes equation or some other partial differential equations that we can write down, which, you know, come, of course, from the real microscopic theory. But at the end, we have to start somewhere. And so this is what I would call the microscopic description is PDEs. And then...
What you really mean, I think, is just the starting point.
Right. The starting point is you have many different systems. Different systems are described by many by different partial differential equations, or different mathematical descriptions at the what you know, and then you take these systems and you ask yourselves, are there generic descriptions possible? In other words, when you take different systems, can you unite these systems by some generic theory? And that theory I would call macroscopic because it captures all this microscopic behavior, but we can find a generic theory. So what we really would like is some generic. Ah, God, what's going on? Generic description. What do I say? Now, this generic description might again be PDEs, right? You might end up, you start with PDEs, you end up with PDEs, but the PDEs can be applied to heart dynamics, as I will get to later, or they can be applied to waves in an oocyte, or they can be applied to brain dynamics. So they can be applied to many, many, a wide variety of problems, and we use the same mathematics, the same description to get to the results of these systems. So that's why I put up this example here. So this is my favorite example of a dissipative system. Not only is it a lot of fun to ski down the dissipative system, but it just shows also very nicely that, you know, the sun comes in and it grows all these beautiful trees, and then snow comes down, and then what we have to do is nothing better than to ski down those mountains. And as a result of that skiing, we see very regular mogul patterns in the mountain. So what you see here is, for example, here is a very nice unit hexagonal unit cell in the structure. And you could imagine the order pattern might be hexagons. Well, you go up a little bit further up here, here you see basically almost squares. So you ask yourself, well, is there an order pattern of squares? And all of you know is that these patterns change. You know, when it's snowed, those of you who are skiers, when you ski down the first time, there's just deep snow. And during the day, these patterns start to build up. And what happens, the cooperative phenomenon of everybody skiing down leads to a regular pattern of mogis. And it's actually relatively ordered. And you also know, if you're a skier, how dissipative that can be. Right? At least for me, it depends how fit you are, how well you get down these things. Okay, so what we observe in these systems is that these systems are, you know, the simpler systems we see, often we see regular patterns. But often these patterns, although they are in principle regular, they have many defects. And very often they are intrinsically time dependent. Now what I mean by this is that these systems will behave forever. As long as they're driven, they will show time dependence. There's nothing like a free energy minimum or some kind of minimization or maximization principle that says the pattern wants to go to something. In general, these patterns don't have that feature. So in other words, these patterns continue to be time dependent and often in a disordered manner. And often we have not only one length scale, sometimes we have multiple length scales to consider and multiple time scales. There are going to be slow time scales and fast time scales. We have to consider that all. Please make comments if you don't disagree.
Yeah, I believe the mountain of snow is, evolves in time, but I mean, not all patterns are time dependent.
Not all patterns are time dependent, that's correct. There are patterns that are time independent, and there are regions in this phase space of patterns where there is actually an energy minimization criterion. Mostly stationary patterns that go to a stationary pattern, very often we can find an energy and then minimize that energy, and the pattern is actually then the pattern that, or it gets close to the pattern that we want, but it's not in general true. Can you hit the little button? Can you hit it again? Okay, so since I am an experimentalist and I am doing really binary convection, I figured I can't get around showing you some pictures from my lab, and also some pictures actually from Günther's lab. I should mention I was a postdoc here with Günther Ahlers. And some of the pictures I show actually go dating back to this not too long ago, right? Good old days. I don't think they were so long ago. Okay, so what I want to talk about is first about physics, because I want to define what it means to look at pattern formation. So I want to use it some model systems. And I will put these model systems in three categories. The first one I would call bulk instabilities. Okay, so this is A. And then we have B, which I called excitable media. Well, let's call them oscillatory media. And then C, interfacial pattern formation. Pardon me? Well, sometimes things are can be in an oscillatory regime. Most of the time what you find is excitable, and I will explain what that means. Okay, so the easiest example is bulk instabilities. And for bulk instabilities, what you do is, let's say you take a fluid layer, you take your cooking pot, you heat the cooking pot from below, you make it very controlled, so everything is nice and flat, and you heat it, and then convection patterns arise, so the fluid comes up. You know, heat is being transported from the bottom to the top. And then you ask yourself, what do these convection patterns look like? And under certain conditions, where you put a lid on the top, you can get what's called Rayleigh-Binard convection, which I've shown here. So you get these stripe patterns. Now, this is an experimental picture. So this is what you can see in an experiment, actually under special initial conditions. But you can see patterns like this. In a large system, you can have perfectly striped rolls, and these things are called, you know, so what you get is you get stripes or rolls. So in the literature, what you will find is that people use actually as soon as they talk about a stripe pattern about rolls, and that might be confusing to some people outside of the field because they see a two-dimensional pattern of stripes and people call them rolls and they wonder, why would that be rolls? Nothing is rolling along here. So these are just stripes. And then let me just show you. So what you can have is you can have these rolls. They could be traveling rolls that could travel to the left or to the right. Why don't you go to the next picture? Or what you can do is you can have a nonlinear superposition. So you have three roll solutions. They can superimpose. And these then lead to the hexagons, very similar to the snow that we had seen before. In this picture, I didn't mention that before, blue is cold fluid flowing down, and red is hot fluid coming up. This is a picture I took in Günther's lab when I was here, and we actually won a few prizes with this picture with a color map. It turns out when you have pictures with very low contrast, color is fantastic, because you can suddenly, something that looks like nothing looks like beautifully. So it was a very hot picture to take, but it's very nice. So we get hexagons, but typically what we see, why don't you go on? So if you drive the system a little stronger, what you can do is, for example, you can get spirals. So again, this is the same picture. White fluid is cold fluid. Black is warm fluid, it's flowing around, but in reality, it's just stripes. And so, for example, what we see here is, why don't you just hit the button, Camilla? No, you're hitting the button too quickly. Okay. It should. Oh, that's the wrong one, sorry. Let me go back. Okay, so here what we have is we have a spiral, and I will explain what that is in a moment. And so what we have here is we have a rotating spiral that breaks up. When it breaks up, it broke actually the chirality. It went from left turning to right turning. And what we do is we end up, so here it is. Now it changed chirality, if you noticed. It went from a left turning to a right turning spiral. And now what we have is we have, at the end, you saw there were four dislocations on the outside, and actually in the middle of four bound dislocations.
Still speeding up, right?
No, this is
sped up by a factor of, yeah. I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20,
right,
compared to the experiment. But it's not speeding up. This is just real, you know, it's just all
the
dynamic speeds up, right? So what this is what I call the birth of a four-armed spiral. Now this is the birth. Why don't you go to the life of a four-armed spiral? Because click on the, yes, and now you have to use the mouse and go and click. Yes. Now that's the life of a four-armed spiral. This time's playing a little slower. And so what you see is you see suddenly the dislocations have all rolled up very, very nicely, equidistant on the outside. And in the middle there are these bound dislocations, they're moving around. Now, what we understand, at this point I can tell you, what we understand is the speed of that rotation. We can say, we can actually predict how fast this thing is rotating. But we do not understand the rotation, this object here in the middle. We don't know what this bound object is. Why don't you go to the next one? So what I'm doing right now is I'm increasing the temperature difference. I drive it differently. So now I drive it harder, and then the spiral is unstable. This form spiral is unstable. It breaks up. It makes a one-armed spiral. Then it breaks up in the middle, and it goes to a new state, which I will show you in the next movie. So you see this? Now it unwound, so it's unbound. So the four dislocations that were in the middle, these four 2π phase jumps, they unbound. One is left, and then the thing breaks up. And then it was called a cross-roll instability. This paper is unstable because it's too wide. It breaks, and you get spiral defect chaos in the middle. So why don't you go to the next movie? And so before we play this, well, you can play it. So what we see there is, this is now when we have everything. So here, what we have here is we have spirals, lots of spirals. We have lots of defects. There's one, there's another, there are grain boundaries. And so this pattern has all the defects a pattern can have, a stripe pattern. I will show you others too, but this one has all these defects. And so if you just think about what stripes could have, if you just think about topology, what you would allow is you would allow targets. Basically, you would allow disclinations. You know, these guys. You would allow, let me see what I can draw these, concave disclinations. So this is a group of disclinations. And then in addition, what you can do is you can take a pattern, you can tear it, which leads you to dislocations. So here we have a, you know, if you go around this, you see this is a plus minus 1/2 disclination, and this is a dislocation where the phase of your object jumps by one wavelength, which means one 2π jump. And then in addition, what you can have are grain boundaries in your system. Things like that, and you have all varieties of grain boundaries. So these patterns are ultimately complicated. They show some very complicated time dependence, and actually this is one of the things that we don't quite fully understand. So why we are keeping this up there?
Why do you not include spirals?
Well, spirals I can make up out of this and that. Then I have a spiral. And if I put two of these in there, then I have a two-armed spiral. I can put in three of them in, then I have a three-armed spiral. Because topologically, a spiral is just, you go around the spiral, if you ignore the phase jump, it's just a target. That's why I didn't, they're part of the thing. Okay, so let me show you another state of spatial temporal chaos. Why don't you go to the other one and then I continue? Oh, this is a simulation where, so what can happen also, what you can also do is you can actually simulate these Navier-Stokes equations. You can simulate them in three dimensions, and this is such a simulation. We started with two dislocations. The dislocation moved to the system, and then what you see is behind, in the wake of the dislocation, the spatial temporal chaos gets created, and it propagates into, it deforms the phase a lot over here, but the phase doesn't tear. It just moves almost basically as a straight line into the system. We see that both experimentally as theoretically. So why don't you go to the next otherwise? Well, now, you shouldn't think that spatial temporal chaos, this disorder in space of time, where the correlations decay quickly, only happens in that form where you have spirals and targets and dislocations. You can also have domain chaos. You can have regions of domains that seem to switch, overlay, come up, and rotate. This is from Günther's lab. This is what's called the Kubrick-Lorentz instability. And the interesting thing about this instability is what happens is you take a system, you drive it a little bit, nothing happens. If you go above a certain threshold, you get these convection rows. This phenomenon happens right at the onset of these convection rows. So this means it happens in the very, very weakly nonlinear regime. It happens right away. And we don't really understand how to describe. They're puzzling things. And if you're interested, Günther gave a talk. It's on the web. There are some correlation times and correlation length. And also, Nathan gave a talk. Is Nathan here? There he is. Nathan gave a talk. And he tells you that there's something wrong with the scaling of the correlation times and lengths and things like that. And we don't quite understand that. Okay. Good. So what do we know about these patterns? You know, the stripe phase. Perhaps I should tell you a little bit about what we know about the stripe phase. And One thing you can do is you can make some type of basically a Floquet or also a Fourier ansatz, and what you can calculate is that you have there's a stable wave number band. Now what that means is that if you can have rolls that are widely spaced, and you can rolls that are spaced like this, and what you know is that there's a certain, you know, if this is what is this now? That's wave length, I guess. And so if you plot this, you know that there is a cutoff to that band. So in other words, for a given situation, you know that there's an instability setting in here, and there's an instability setting in here. Anything in between here is stable. If you reach this instability boundary, something breaks. You saw that when you might have noticed when the spiral was getting off center, the first movie, it squeezed the rolls, and as a result, it pinched off. That's one of those instabilities. Then what else do we know? Well, if you take a striped face, well, you can think about it. What you can do is you can think about this face. Well, these are stripes. So what you say, well, if I go back and just think about the face, not the striped face, just think about the face, you know, as in Engi. Okay? So if you take the face and describe only the face of a pattern. So you only ask your pattern. If I bend the pattern, it changes some properties. If I compress the pattern, I change something. And so what I can write down is what's called the phase equation. The nice thing about this phase equation is that I have an equation for the phase, which also works when I'm very nonlinear. Because all I've done is I captured the phase dynamics. It might be, you know, coupled to another equation and so on, but I can write down nonlinear phase equations. And that brings us quite far, as long as the pattern doesn't tear. As soon as the pattern tears, we have to incorporate these very rapid changes in the amplitude of the pattern. And that causes trouble. And actually, we don't know how to connect these two. It's like in solid state physics, if you have a dislocation, a real dislocation, edge dislocation, and you know there's an elasticity field around the dislocation, but at the dislocation, you're in trouble. And so the question is, how can you regularize these phase equations, or what do you do with it? And we actually don't know how to do that. And I guess was this a result of the last ITP meeting, the phase equations? Kind of. Two years delayed, but there was a meeting in 1982. Right, and this is from 1984, 86, and then in the meantime, pardon me? Something like that. And in the meantime, people have actually derived these phase equations for Rayleigh-Bernard convection, I mean rigorously. But the problem is they don't tell you the full story because you know how your fingerprint can be described until it tears, and that's the problem.
Is the driving force in all these pictures heat?
In this case, it's just that, yes, in these pictures, because we are heating, you know, we cool from the top, we heat from below, and we get, you know, these convection rolls. This is what we see from the top down, and the control parameter is the temperature difference. So at a critical temperature difference, you see the onset of that phenomenon, and if you increase the temperature difference further and further, the system gets, you know, more and more disordered, like here, in a very regular manner, you know, with instabilities and so on. Oh, the dark, okay. So what happens is here the fluid, so what we do is we use what's called the shadow graph technique. What this plots basically is the mid-plane temperature. So if you just imagine the mid-plane temperature, it would look like that. White is cold, black is warm. But what we really do is we send light through this, and these act like lenses, and the light defocuses and focuses. And so what you can just imagine, it turns out actually almost perfectly if you plot the mid-plane temperature in a simulation, it just looks like that. Okay, so one question is, you know, how do we characterize these phase singularities that we have in this problem, like grain boundaries, dislocations? What do we do with them? And then the question is, can we describe systems that are spatial temporal chaotic? Now, this is all physics. So let me just now go on to reaction diffusion systems. And you might all have heard about the BZ reaction. I don't know, who has heard about the BZ reaction? Well, quite a few of you. Okay, well, at least all the ones that are not in the string theory program, they should have. Which string theorists have heard about BZ?
BZ reaction. It's not the Zangwill reaction. It's the losers.
Of
the reaction. You've heard about it, okay?
Okay. That just that you look and feel better. I did a search yesterday in the web, and the word pattern formation self-organization is quoted 400,000 times, and string theory is quoted 330,000
times. Google makes it possible. No. We obviously have a lot of web pages.
You know? Apple Media mentioned even more, and I got into a sex place. Germany. It was a German place, and mentioned Excitable Media, and don't drink German. It turned out that they use Excitable Media. That's why Oscillator maybe should be included.
Okay, busy reaction. Can you click on the next thing? So I was able to download. Oh, okay. I should also, before I go on, there's also other way. Oops, go back. Can you go back? No. Yes, go back. Another one. So there are other systems. Gunnar didn't have a movie on the web, but you can have is you can have different waves overlap each other, and they can come up in a disordered manner. And this makes this pattern like here. And I'm sure Gunnar will put up a movie sometime when he gets the data from Mike Denon. But this is another way you can have spatiotemporal chaos. So there are different ways of spatiotemporal chaos. And one of the problems, we don't really know how to distinguish them. We look at them, you know, they look different, but are they really different, or are they the same, or the universality classes? What is the structure? So please go to the. So this is the BZ reaction, which is, I find, a beautiful movie. So you just pour some chemicals together, and so then the chemicals have nothing better to do than to blink. So what you see here is, this is a stirred reactor. So it's basically an Erlenmeyer flask with some fluid with a magnet on the bottom. It's being stirred. And what happens is that there's now a chemical reaction where the system goes from one state to another. And this, we have an indicator in there, and the indicator changes, shows us in what state the system is. So every 3 seconds, it seems to blink. So here it is, right? So this is this BZ reaction. And now what happens when you take this BZ reaction and you put it in two dimensions? So you stop stirring, okay? You just put it in a Petri dish. Put it actually into gel to avoid any type of convection you might generate. You make a few tricks, but basically it's just, imagine there's this mixture sitting there on the surface, and if you go to the next picture, what you get is this. So this is a Petri dish with this BZ reaction, and what you find out is you now get waves propagating through your system. So instead of just blinking, the system now has waves, excitable waves, propagating to the system. And you also see spirals, which is not so surprising, because anytime you get a target, you can make something round. You put a defect dislocation in the middle, it's a spiral. The surprise in these systems is that, in contrary to my Rayleigh-Binard spirals, where the spiral core could actually be eliminated when the calculation is done, it's passive, it's there, but it's not important. It's the far field that matters. In these excitable media, the spiral core is very important. This little 2-pi phase jump in the middle generates the frequency the spiral rotates by. So the spiral, this core, without this little hole in the middle, there would be no wave. But if you put this little hole in, suddenly there's a spiral wave and propagates. And this is the problem when people go into. You mean on a.
It runs around the Petri dish.
Oh, it's just a wave that runs around the Petri dish.
People run around the annulus because it's kind of like a plus minus topological counter spiral inside there.
Right, and actually we have a picture of such an annulus, right? Don't I? A movie? Yes.
Sorry, how is this system being driven?
This is a complicated set of. Pardon me.
That looks like it's decaying. The equilibrium
right.
problem.
So right. You have to feed in. You have to feed in the reactor. If it's just sitting there.
It will eat itself up.
It
right.
will die out. As the reactants get depleted, but. In these, you actually can. People have constructed experiments where they feed the reactants
constantly.
Continuously.
They have a sheet of gel. They have a sheet of right. They have a sheet of gel and they feed it from both sides. Right. Okay. So if you go on, so let me show you. So here is example, if you have to, I think you have to go in with a mouse. So this is the example of an excitable medium with a wave propagating in an annulus. Right? So right there it is. Okay, that's what I meant by annulus. It's right there. So if you go to the next picture, there has been this paper in Nature
You know, it's called Mexican Waves in an Excitable Medium. It was by Vicek, who's going to be here actually at the ITP. And I think this came out in Nature. Yeah. And so why don't you go on? And so what's important for these excitable media is that you have an inactive part where you just sit around, you're ready to fire. So you're sitting there with your flash charged, right? Your flash on your lamp, sometimes at night there are these waves propagating through a stadium just with the flashes. And so that's actually a much nicer example because it takes the photo a time to recharge. And so that's the refractory period. Okay, so you can't shoot right away again because your photo won't do it. So then you have the refractory period. So what you need is you need to get excited. You shoot your photo, or you make just the light glow, and then you're active, and then you go in a refractory period. And so this is why this is such a very, very universal phenomenon. Now, something interesting in this phenomenon is that shows you, if I would describe the Luther-Zabosinski reactions, I would assume a continuum approach, right? I would say these are chemicals, they diffuse, they're continuous. In this system, what I do is I have to take into account that they're people. Some of them might be drunk. They might be sitting around. They might be empty chairs, which means there are regions where there's nobody sitting. The question is, what do these effects have to do? And this is actually where the analogy to biology comes immediately in, because in biology we have cells. And the cells react to stimuli. And sometimes they're disordered, sometimes they're a little bit different than the cell next door. And so randomness in these systems, and also thermal noise in biological systems, here only if you're really drunk, you could say there might be some thermal agitation. But this is so this is the system. Okay, now, so what we saw is in the BC reaction, we saw that we had a target, and the target would travel mostly outside. It could travel inward too, but mostly it's observed to travel outward. And then we get these spiral waves. And the spiral waves are either, you know, rotating like this or rotating like that, right? Did I get it right? Yes, yes. So you can have the plus 2 pi and the minus 2 pi dislocations. And of course, now if you have a reaction diffusion system and you go to 3D, what do you get? So this was, we go to, so in 1D, we just have a source of activity, right? It's like a pacemaker. Things are sent out. In two dimensions, I get a spiral. So I have a dislocation in the middle, right? I have some kind of spot where the phase is not defined. It jumps by 2 pi if I go around it. And now I make the system three-dimensional. What do I get? Well, they're called scrolls, but what you really get is you get a type of spiral in three dimensions. So in other words, instead of having this point in the middle, you get if this is the sheet of my medium, let's say it would be a sheet of hard muscle or a sheet of the BZ reaction, what I find is they're filaments. They're string-like objects, and these string-like objects are nothing else than these points where this phase jumps by 2 pi. Okay? Good. And then we can have another system, which is interfacial instabilities. So that would be the last one of the physics. And there's just a picture. Pardon me?
This is the connection to string theory, because this is the 1D string of the three-dimensional BZ.
Right. Yes, exactly. So there's a connection. Well, which is rare. You know, imagine there are two programs here that actually have a connection. Mm-hmm. So what we also have is we have diffusion, you know, interfacial instability. And interfacial instability is what this, for example, is. I mean, do you know where this picture is from? Anybody? What it could mean? Who comes from a cold climate? Some of you must have seen these things happen on the windshield, right? Yeah, basically, yeah. These are basically snowflakes. This is a transparent alloy, you know, it mimics a metallic alloy, which is solidifying. And when it's solidifying, it grows. This is a single crystal, and it's growing this way. Actually, turbine plates in an aircraft are made that way. There's a single crystal growing through the whole turbine plate, but the single crystal is not, you know, beautifully as you think of a silicon bowl. It's going to be a thing that looks like this. But it's very important, because if there's more than one crystal, the turbine plate will not hold and will fly apart, and you don't want that. So what this is a diffusion limiter. It's called Zeffman-Taylor instability. No, not Zeffman-Taylor. It's wrong. Well, Zeffman-Taylor works. Pardon me? Mullins-Kirker instability, exactly. So you have the Mullins. So what happens is, basically, if you think an infinite system where you're growing, so you have here the concentration against space,
And you just look at the concentration. What do you have here? You have the solid. Then this is the interface. And before it, you get diffusion, either of heat or of some alloy component. And this jump here leads to that instability. Right? Of course, there are specialists here who want to disagree.
It's 1 minus the concentration.
Oh, it's 1 minus?
That, forget it.
Well, it's the concentration change. Okay. Yeah. Yes, it's the concentration. It's the delta C. Okay? Now you okay? Okay. Good. There's another region where you have to worry about interfacial instabilities, and that's when you have attachment kinetics. In other words, when the growth is limited by attachment kinetics. Here, stuff flies in and sticks. If you think about a faceted crystal growing, what happens is you have step edges and things come in and grow along and grow along. So we have that. Okay. So let me just summarize. So far we have continuum systems mostly. There was, other than my people, there was no discreteness. Typically KT is much, much smaller than one. What I mean by that is thermal noise is mostly not important. Now Kunde has experiments with thermal noise is very important, but in general, we don't worry too much about thermal noise. And usually there's relatively little randomness. Systems are relatively ordered and controlled, and there's very little randomness. And now you ask yourself, what do we know about these systems? Where are we in describing these systems? And what we know is we have what's called a weakly nonlinearly. So when the system is only driven a little bit, we can know actually quite a lot. Because then we can write down some WKB approximations. We can write down what's called amplitude equations and actually get somewhere. We get a feeling of what's there. We understand pretty much the wavelength selection. We know where the instabilities are. We can describe those instabilities. We understand a lot about dislocations and grain boundaries, but probably not enough. And we understand quite a bit about spiral dynamics. And we also understand quite a bit about front propagation in systems. So you have a front, and the front goes from one state to another, and the front propagates, or it's a localized front, pulses that propagate. The question is, if you drive the system very strongly, what happens? So if you take the system, drive it stronger, or what happens in these spatiotemporal chaotic states? And another question is, often in these systems, you not just have one field, like the temperature, but you have another field, and these two fields live, for example, at two different wavelengths. So one is a zero mode, it's almost a zero wave number, and the other one is at the pattern wave number, and these two modes interact, and you ask yourself what is going to come out of that. And typically what happens is you get spatiotemporal chaos. Okay, so let me go to biology. So let's just switch now, and let's see what the biology was in the name. So this is where very coarsely we are in terms of pattern formation, and my colleagues might disagree with me or agree. In pattern formation, there are some obvious examples in biology, right? What are typical examples? Animal coats. They are tigers, right? They have beautiful patterns and so on. So they are obvious mollusks, seashells. They show pretty patterns. And in addition, there are some periodic structures that you can find at the beach in Santa Barbara with defects and stripes. And here you go. It's not. It hasn't been decaying. Not more than it was when I picked it up on the beach yesterday. It has been sitting in water, so you know I try to preserve the structure because I notice when they dry up, they lose the structure. Okay, so this is a periodic structure. You can see the dislocations and the defects and everything in there. And so there's the obvious pattern formation, but there's also the non-obvious pattern formation, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit. And the question is, why would we suddenly start to think about biology? You know, what has happened in biology that makes us confident of addressing problems in biology? You know, before biology was so complex that you wouldn't get any insights. And the things that happened is that we can now study the dynamics of gene expression. We can actually have a handle on gene expression. We can worry about how proteins interact. We can actually now measure how proteins interact. We have gene manipulation techniques. We can change genes in cells and see what the cells does if we kick out that one gene or put another gene in. So we can actually see what the dynamics of a cell is. In addition, there's lots of new imaging techniques. The main advantage is we now have lots of fluorescent probes that we can put inside of a cell. For example, we can tag a protein. We can put what's called GFP, green fluorescent protein, which is from jellyfish, right? And you can attach that to a protein, and you can show that most likely it doesn't change the function of the protein, but suddenly we see that protein. Well, and biologists are clever, and physicists and chemists, and so they made a YFB and a RFB, and so they have different colors, red, yellow, right? And so we have different colors to look at different genes, why they're moving, different proteins, why they're moving around in the cell. In addition, what we can do is we can put in fluorescent markers, so we can put in dyes. And these dyes, for example, could be calcium dyes. And it's very important for all the movies I'm going to show you in the last bit of this talk, is what we do is we image with calcium dyes. And the nice thing is these calcium dyes react now on milliseconds. So we really can look in the time evolution of the biology at very rapid time scales. So we can now see things that we couldn't see before because the time scales are so much faster. Okay, well then there are other measurements. You can measure diffusion, you can use what's called FRET. I don't know, it's called fluorescent electron transfer measurements. What you do is you have two dyes, you bring them together, either it extinguishes the fluorescence or it enhances the fluorescence, depending. So you see nothing, you see something. So you can look at single molecule interactions now. You can see how proteins or molecules come together, how they fold, things like that. Then there is a new technique called two-photon microscopy, where you can look into a tissue and see what's happening at a micron scale inside the tissue. So you can go in and probe, you know, a piece of tissue and look inside of the tissue and measure locally what's going on. And there are other techniques. But what do you do with this? Well, what people do is you can look at single molecule dynamics. You can look at intracellular dynamics, which means inside of the cell. You can take a cell and look what's happening in the cell if you do something to the cell, or what does the cell do by itself. You can look at intercellular dynamics, which means if you have multiple cells, how do the cells behave? And you can look at multicellular things, where, for example, you can ask yourself, what does a whole organ do, like the heart, the liver, the brain? What is happening at the really large scale? So you can go all the way from a single cell, which is 10 microns, to, they have very large ones too, 1 millimeter, up to, you know, 30 centimeters, 40 centimeters. And you can ask yourself, how do we go from one to the others, and are there similarities? And in addition, one can now make very well-controlled experiments. We can now have microfluidics, we have other techniques, where we can make really very nice controlled experiments with biological samples. We can look at one cell and give the chemicals to one cell that we want the cell to see and nothing else. And so we can really make very tailored experiments. And in addition, people have started to make artificial intracellular networks. What's meant there is that you have, for example, you have a receptor, the system binds something on the receptor, and something starts to happen downstream, and people can put in the bacterium artificial networks. They can design a network, put it in the bacterium, and see how is that working. And as you already see, you have these networks, and these networks are intrinsically nonlinear. You have very many components that interact, and the way biologists describe this is typically by, if you open a biology book, you see pictures. It's cartoon-like. You have things that say this down-regulates that, this up-regulates this. But what's missing are the timescales. Very often, biologists don't know about the timescales. They don't know when what happened. They only say, well, this happened before this, but when before is not clear. So what you have is you have a complex network of things, and that leads to certain structure. And so let me just show you some examples. So this is a sea urchin. It should start. This is in 3D. It's fancy. You know, these biologists know very well how to use computers these days. And so what this was, this is a sea urchin egg. So this is a single cell which is being fertilized. And what's imaged with a dye is the calcium ions, the free calcium ions. And so what you see in this image, that the egg is being fertilized on this side. And then a wave, a calcium wave, propagates. It's not really, it's like a pulse. A pulse is propagating through the cell and tells the cell you have been fertilized. So where is it? Should start again. What is happening? How long is this movie? Okay, it's much longer than I thought. I never watched it that long. Okay, well, there it is again. So let's just see it. So here you are. And then the calcium pulse propagates through the cell. So at the cellular scale, where you just have one little cell, you know, this is a small cell, you see already localized phenomena that come from one side and go to the other. Why don't you go to the next movie? This is an oocyte, which is basically a frog egg. This is a relatively large cell. It's about a millimeter across. And again, what you can do is you can visualize the calcium dynamics inside of that cells. Now, these systems all behave very much like excitable media. So, you know, like I've shown you before, which was like Belousov-Zabuzinsky reaction. And so what you see here is, actually, we just had a talk last week on this by him. And what you see here is you see these spiral waves which come about just in the frog egg, just sitting there, and you can image the spiral wave. It's confocal microscopy. So they only look at, they don't look at the whole egg. They look at a certain layer inside of the egg. Okay, why don't you show the next?
This is a dye. Right?
This is a dye. So what it shows you the free calcium. That's what it does. Now this, what people do is nowadays is they can take cells and put cells on a Petri dish, like heart cells, and let them just assemble each other, and then you have a tissue, basically, a very thin layer of heart cells which grow on the Petri dish, and then people can put again a dye in and visualize these spiral waves in the dye. We had a talk in the Pattern Formation Conference 3 weeks ago, where somebody looked at the contraction of these little cells, and you also see spiral waves. So even if you don't do anything to your cells, no dye, you just watch them, then you can just see these contraction waves, which are again spiral waves. Why don't you go to the next one? This is now very large scale. So this is calcium waves in the hippocampal, in the hippocampal slice. So this is a relatively large piece of brain, which is cut out, and you can again use a calcium dye. And what you observe again are these spiral waves. So it's probably playing again. You see these puffs first, which suggests some randomness, which the whole conference was pretty much about. And then what you see here is you see these, again, these big, huge spiral waves propagating. Okay? Now, if you go to different slice, if you go to retinal cells, why don't you go to the next one? So these are calcium, so this is a glia cells. Glia cells are between, between the neurons. So this is retinal. So this is a retinal glia. And what you do, they stimulate, you can actually see a little bit the cells and little fibers in between. So that's, again, a piece of tissue cut out. And what you can do is you can excite that piece of tissue, and then you see this calcium wave propagating through the system.
So the glia is used to transmit signals?
Yes, the glia is actually transport signals. So in other words, in your brain, you have neurons and glias, glia cells. And for a long time, it was believed that glia cells are passive, don't do anything. It turns out they have very slow signals that propagate there. And we heard last week that this might lead to migraines and epilepsy and things like that, when you have these glia cells participating in the dynamics of the neurons. They can feed back to the neurons.
Right. It's thought that they were saying that the neurons do the fast dynamics and the glia the slow.
So the brain is much more complicated than we thought. It's still complicated. It's just complicated squared or something. Okay, so why don't you go to the next one? And this is a picture. So now I get to the last point that I wanted to make on just on pictures. Now you ask yourself, these are spiral waves, again visualized with a dye in a heart muscle. So now it's, you have a heart muscle. You excite that one spot, and what you get is a spiral wave, which is self-sustained and just sits there and rotates. I didn't find a movie of that. But it was very much like the little Petri dish. So if you take the Petri dish model and you take the real heart, what do you find out? You get spiral waves. And now you ask yourself, well, why is that important? But people believe that this is what happens in fibrillation. So in fibrillation of the heart, what happens, what people believe, what happens is in a healthy heart, you have the pacemaker, and the pacemaker sends out a signal, and the waves propagate. Well, if these waves encounter an obstacle, they basically make a pair of spiral waves. The spiral waves turn out to have a higher frequency of rotation than the pacemaker. Because it's an excitable system, you can think about the people standing up, they win against the pacemaker. What now happens is people are considered, you know, that's what said, is people are what's called tachycardia. So now what you have is you have now this one boring spiral, but the frequency of the heart is much faster because it's faster, but it still pumps because everything, there's still pulses, right? It doesn't matter who made the pulses, there's still pulses. It pulses perhaps a little, it pumps a little less, but it still pumps. But now what happens is that spiral can go into spiral TV. So this spiral, why don't you go to the next movie, which is a simulation which should be taken with a little bit of grain of salt. So this is a heart not moving. This is a simulation of a heart dynamics model. And what happens there is there's one spiral, and that spiral breaks up. Mm-hmm. What that means is it goes spatiotemporal chaotic. And if it goes spatiotemporal chaotic, There's excitations on the heart which are uncoordinated. It's totally out of phase. Everything is out of phase. So effectively, the heart muscle is pumping harder than ever because the frequency is very high, but it's just sitting there like a pudding going up and down. And that's when you have a piece of heart in your hand, it does that. It just fibrillates. But it's actually the muscles work like crazy until they run out of oxygen, and then the person dies. That's why people survive when you get fast enough to them and just reset the whole system. You know, you pull the plug, you hit the reset button, then they come back. But it would be nice to actually find methods to control this, to put something into the heart, which we actually don't know. We don't know how to get rid of these things. It's very hard to get rid. They are topological. That's one of the big problems, is that they have this very topological character, these sources of activation. And it's very hard to get rid of these spiral waves.
But isn't it partially that the refractory period is shorter than it needs to be? I mean, to get the spiral waves at a higher frequency means that the refractory time is actually short. Right? Because if the refractory time was just such that you were ready to go when that signal came.
It's in the pulse time.
What a long refractory period to avoid.
The way you make this, I can tell you a make where you can make this dynamically. What you can make is you can pace the heart faster and faster and faster. Then you go in a period 2 bifurcation.
Yeah.
And then you go to what's called conduction block, which we will hear about here, which means every second pulse is missing. So you have a pulse, nothing. Now, if that would happen locally in a heart muscle, so you have a big heart muscle, everywhere else it propagates through nicely, but at one point it blocks. Then you get this topological, then you get this reentrance, as they call it, you get a spiral building up. It's actually unknown how these spirals, why these come about. You know, people that are really sick, they know they have to happen. You have a big anatomical defect in your heart. People find that. But a lot of people die where they don't see anything, or very little. And the question is, where's that coming from? And everything points in the direction that there might be some dynamical thing. You know, you run fast, you go very fast, the heart rate goes up. There's a dynamical instability, which picks up very weak inhomogeneities in the heart muscle. In addition, now I get there to
In answer to your question, it's not a question of tuning of parameters. The spirals are intrinsically the fastest,
right,
roughly speaking, excitation.
Right. They select the frequency.
Faster than the pacemaker.
Right. They select the frequency. And so what you have is, you know, Alan Carman and others have worked on this. What you really have is a heart muscle, right? And a heart muscle is three-dimensional. And so what you really have is these strings. In reality, what you have is you don't have a spiral. What you have is a line defect, which is called a scroll wave. In addition, the heart is anisotropic. The muscle fibers go around, you know, like this. So what the karma model suggests is, because of the intrinsic heterogeneity of the heart, because of the three-dimensionality, the spiral rotates faster here than in the bottom, which winds up that filament. And at some stage, this filament starts to basically break up and makes spatiotemporal chaos. But this is really not understood. What people know, that in two-dimensional slices you have spiral waves. Nobody has really succeeded imaging in 3D. No one. There's no three-dimensional imaging. And so we will have actually, we will have 6 workshops throughout that program. There was one on calcium dynamics. There is going to be one on heart dynamics. It turns out, as you've seen in the brain, there are also the same waves in the brain. So what we try to do is mingle the heart dynamics people with the brain people. So there will be another workshop on brain dynamics, where on spiral waves in the brain. Then there is one workshop.
Together are called hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds, yes. This is hearts and minds, yes. And then we have one workshop on calcium dynamics, glia cells. So if you're interested, drop in. You know, just listen in on glia cells. Then there's one mini workshop on the immune system. You know, how the immune system functions, because of course this dynamics happens on larger scales too, not just on the scales of a cell or on the liver. I mean, it happens over the whole body. And then, in addition, after that, we have one on cancer growth, which goes to interfacial instabilities. So let me show you the last picture. This is a picture that I got from Eschel this morning, which shows you the growth of bacteria. Actually, the active growth of bacteria is out here. And in here, the bacteria have already eaten the food, and they basically changed into where they kind of hibernate. They're just sitting there and wait. But you see that these things lead to very intricate interfacial patterns, which then you can start thinking. And people have worked a lot on crystal growth and other things, and they've developed phase field models. They've developed theories, very sophisticated theories to describe these phenomena. Len has worked already, has already a paper on cancer growth in the brain. And so the question is, can we use the theory that was developed for interfacial instabilities and apply it to these things where, for example, cancer grows with filamentation, where the things grow in the regular tissue, and really learn something from that for the future. So let me close with a few remarks. So one question number A is, can we understand many component complex spatiotemporal phenomena? In other words, can we use simple dynamics to explain complex phenomena? Because that's kind of what we're doing. We're trying to deduce everything to simple it. But then when we put it all together, it might be very, very complex phenomena. And are there complexity hierarchies? So in other words, are there different hierarchies of complexity, which would be nice that you don't have to understand everything. You can understand parts of the system and their hierarchies. But and are they generated dynamically? Are they coming about because of dynamics? Then the question is, are there well-characterized examples? Like there are actually examples that I've shown you that in pattern formation where biological function is accomplished. For example, but for the egg to be fertilized, there is some, most likely there's biological function involved in this kind of pattern formation process. And so are there systems like that? Then the question is, what carries over from the traditional pattern formation, which has been around for 20 years, let's say, of the order of 20 years, or a little longer? And, pardon me? Depends how old you are. So perhaps almost 30 years or longer. And so the question is, what carries over from traditional pattern formation? What can be used, the stuff that was developed over the last X decades, what can be used now for bringing it to biology? Or do we have to invent totally new techniques? Because in biology, you have cells, right? It's discrete, intrinsically discrete. You have inhomogeneities, which you have to worry about more. And so there are very new noise, KT noise, suddenly plays a role. And so the question is, what mathematical, numerical, and experimental approaches should one use? You know, especially mathematically and numerically. How should we address all these questions? What is the best way of doing it? And me as an experimentalist, I would also like to know what experiments are the best ones to do. And so I already said that. And the one question, of course, that's at the end is, can we use results from pattern formation and cure some diseases? Can we actually go and find a cure to cardiac fibrillation? I mean, this would be the big example for pattern formation where you actually, you know, did something to mankind, because, you know, I don't know how many hundred thousands of people die in the US of cardiac arrest, and they could all be saved or cured or helped if you could do that. Then in closing, let me say that so far the conference has shown that the biological world and the physics world is really quite separated. What I mean by that is they're very sophisticated experimentalists in the biological community, and they are very sophisticated theorists in the physics side of things, and the communication between the two doesn't quite work yet. Biologists are, I mean, they have to forgive me for saying this, but sometimes they're quite happy of having five cells that behave in a certain manner and show a phenomenon and then go on. What the conference showed is that our theorists really have to convince biologists and other physicists to make experiments to their liking. In other words, what I mean by that, there are predictions from theories. So far, you can, from the conference, it was clear there are two types of theories. The one theory just repeats the experiment and says, yes, the theory shows the same thing as the experiment. But what you really want to do is that the theory goes further and says there are predictions. But often, the biologists are so happy about their results that they don't want to go back to the lab and repeat the experiment, because the theorists have some abstruse phase space, which is biologically totally irrelevant, right? To do an experiment just to show the theory works. But I think this meeting has already generated two new connections. I mean, the first meeting, Eshel has now a collaboration with Towel at Chicago. He's a neurosurgeon.
The data that he took from patients that they're going to run into surgery.
Right. So what they actually do is they put electrodes in the head of people that have epilepsy. They have electrodes. They cut everything open here, put electrodes in, and watch the patient for a week to find out where's the center for epilepsy. And he talked to Eshel, who has neurons on the Petri dish. And they found out they have commonalities between patients and the little Petri dish, which is very exciting. And then Martin Falke has set up a collaboration with what's the guy in England?
No, in England, the first talk. The first talk. Taylor? Colin Taylor, right, was the first talk. So he also, the theorist again with an experimentalist who came together and so on. So if the meeting continues like this, you know, if we see every meeting one collaboration, I think we have been quite successful. Well, thank you very much.